Okay, good morning, everybody. Hope you be well, and I'm going to continue a little bit with what we were talking about last week. It's really a post-Shavuos discussion, but it's relevant by halacha the whole year. That is, we were talking about the fact that the Omer that is brought the second day of Pesach, the Korban Omer, the barley offering that was brought the second day of Pesach, has a very important permitting function, and that is, one is not allowed to eat what is called chadash. Chadash are the five grains that belong to the new year until the Omer is brought. Meaning, until the Omer is brought, you are not allowed to eat chadash. Now, the definition of chadash, that was a little tricky. Chadash means any grain that was either planted after the Omer, or even if it was planted before the Omer, it took root after the Omer. And Chazal were matabel that it takes around 14 days for a plant to take root. So in other words, the following. If I planted wheat 3 weeks before Pesach, even though nothing is above ground yet, technically the Omer that I bring on the second day of Pesach will matur that grain. So when it grows and I harvest it later, that's not chadash. I could eat it. It was yashan because it already was mushrash before the Omer. Masha ein kein, if I didn't plant it till after the Omer date, or even if I planted it before the Omer date, but it was less than 2 weeks before the Omer date, the Omer does not matir. It's called chadash. And even if I harvest it, I'm not going to be allowed to eat it until next Omer date. Vis-a-vis the next Omer date, it's Yashan. That's why it's very confusing. Vis-a-vis a given Omer, it's Chadash. Vis-a-vis the next Omer, it'll be Yashan because it already had been rooted in the ground afterwards. Right. So this is the Isser of Chadash. It does not apply to fruit. It does not apply to vegetables. It only applies to the Chamishas. Chameshes, mine, dagan, and that would be chita, wheat, saora, barley, then it's a shifon, which is rye, and kusmin, which is spelt, and shibola shuel, which according to the vast majority of opinions is oats, but I did mention to you that there was a professor Yehuda Felix, who was a religious man and a Talmud Chacham, and an expert in botany, who actually claims that because oats did not really exist in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Torah, he claimed Shibola Shoah was something else, and oats, in fact, were not one of the five species. Now that has enormous repercussions. That would mean that you couldn't be yotzei with oat matzah, which people with gluten intolerance use. You would not make ala michya, you would not bench, you would not take off challah. In other words, he treated oats like rice, and I actually don't remember what he substituted for oats, but he had another species. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach said on Rav Felix's maskana that although it was very, very interesting, but he said he was not going to change the halachic mesira of at least 1,000 years, that Shibola Shoel is oats. But be it as it may, we'll go with that assumption. I don't want to make people more crazy. We'll go with Shibola Shoel is oats. That's how everybody postulates today. And that is the din of Chadash. Now, today there's no Beis HaMikdash, tragically, although maybe with the fall of the government, who knows, you know, what will happen here. Maybe we're on a messianic cusp and the like. Although, I don't know how long Lapid is going to be prime minister. Maybe it's only a few weeks until the election, but...
It said March 25th.
Oh.
No.
That's a long time.
October.
Yeah. Oh, October. Yeah. Baruch Hashem. I mean, the shorter the better, but he could do a lot of damage even in a short time.
But he continues to be prime minister during the negotiations for the new coalition and all. So that could be a while. It could be to the end of the year.
You're talking about Lapid.
Yes.
Lapid. Okay. Well, later. Sometimes it's a little bit of a reminder that before Mashiach comes, you have to have like the darkest moment, like the night is darkest, darkest before the dawn. So that would be the situation. But we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. So you'll recall that the way it works is that when there's a Beis HaMikdash and a Korban Omer, Chadash is forbidden until you bring the Omer. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, it is the day itself that matirs the Chadash. Now, what is the day? The day is the second day of Pesach, which is the 16th of Nisan. Mm-hmm. And that would actually mean that the Oraisa, when there's no Beis HaMikdash, you're allowed to eat Chadash, the crack of dawn, on the 16th of Nisan. The crack of dawn. And I mentioned, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a takana that you have to wait until the 17th of Nisan. If you remember, the reason why he made that takana was that if I got habituated to eating Chadash, the crack of dawn, the 16th of Nisan, then next year when they build the Beis HaMikdash, I'll do the same habit, but I'm not allowed to eat it yet because they didn't bring the Omer till a few hours later. So in order to be sure that I'm not going to jump the gun and eat the Chadash earlier that I'm allowed to eat it, he was misakin that you cannot eat Chadash on the 16th of Nisan. You got to wait until the 17th of Nisan. Okay. But that's the halacha today, that Chadash cannot be eaten. Whatever is Chadash cannot be eaten until the morning of the 17th of Nisan. And in Chutz La'aretz, because of the Sveka Dioma, you actually have to wait until the 18th of Nisan.
So that means you could eat it during Chol Hamoed Pesach.
That's correct.
And is it permitted to make matzah during Chol Hamoed Pesach?
So the truth of the matter is, yes. You could even make a matzah on Pesach itself because you're allowed to cook. I mean, on the first day, you're allowed to cook in Pesach. However, the minhag of Ashkenazim is we don't do it. In fact, in the time of the Gemara, it was very, very common that they did daily baking and they baked matzah because, once again, you take the flour and the water, you make sure it doesn't become chametz, you know, 18 minutes, and you bake it. However, Ashkenazim don't do that at all because we don't want to use any type of flour. I mean, maybe matzah meal if you don't keep the din of kibbutz. But we don't bake with flour on Pesach because we're too afraid that it'll become chametz thick and everything else. But Meikir Hadin, now let me point out an obvious point. Regular flour, and I include whether it's white flour, whether it's whole wheat flour, whatever type of flour you have, regular flour is automatically assumed not to be kosher for Pesach. Now why is that? Flour per se is not chametz automatically. But the problem is that today, which was not the case in the olden days, and maybe some organic stuff may be the same, today all flour is washed in water. It's rinsed off in various ways or soaked. So as a result, our assumption, which may or may not be true in a given case, is all flour is considered to be chametz. Matzah meal, we say, was not because that was prepared for matzah. You know, matzah meal, if it has a hechsher. But regular flour is halakhically treated as chametz. Even though, once again, I want to emphasize, it's not intrinsically chametz, meaning if the flour was not in contact with water for 18 minutes, it's not chametz. But we assume that all flour is washed today, or the wheat is washed today. So you cannot use flour for any type of baking.
I think they use water to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Okay, yeah.
And
So it's almost 100%. Now again, maybe if you find some organic or rustic, you know, all natural flour, maybe they don't do it, but virtually all commercial flour is washed. Yeah.
So now, today in America, is everybody matpid?
Okay, so now let me just remind you, I'll just review a little bit. The din of Chadash in Eretz Yisrael is an absolute chiyuv. The grain that grows in Eretz Yisrael, there is an iser of Chadash. According to so many opinions, it's an iser of the Oraisa, etc. But you don't have to worry about it because your hashkacha will take care of it, meaning hashkachos will not allow grain products on the markets unless it's already yashan. So you don't have to worry. So Chadash is something you don't have to worry about if your hashkacha is reliable. Whatever hashkacha you rely upon will take care of Chadash. Now, when it comes to Chutz La'aretz, there's a huge machlokes haposkim if the Isser of Chadash applies in Chutz La'aretz. Now again, let me explain the issue, Bekitzer. As a general rule, we might have assumed it doesn't apply, and the reason is because agricultural mitzvahs normally don't apply outside of Eretz Yisrael, Truma, Miser. And yet, because the Torah uses the phrase by Chadash, B'chol Moshvo Seichem, wherever you live, there is an opinion in the Gemara that that includes Chutz La'aretz. So as a result, it's a huge, huge, huge machlokas. Now, for various reasons, the mainstream hashkachos in the United States have followed the lenient view. So the OU, the Chavkei, all of these different things, will certify products even though they are Chadash, because they say we could follow the views that Chadash is mutter, and Chutz La'aretz or various other leniencies. So as a result, unless you see specifically that it's certified, that it's Yashan, you cannot assume that it's Chadash. I'm sorry, that it's Yashan. Certainly the OU does not certify that the product is Yashan. So that's why people are machmering this. That's why we have directories, we have product codes. If you're sophisticated, I'm not sophisticated, but through a product code on a box of cookies or pasta, you can tell when it was harvested. Again, you understand that it depends on the time of year. This time of year, there is no problem of Chadash, because you understand, any grain product that is in a store right now must have taken root before Pesach. Because if it was planted after Pesach, or whatever it would be, it wouldn't have reached market yet. So, in a very simple way, I'm going to be very, very approximate here. Generally speaking, any product that you buy between Pesach and Sukkot, I'm being very approximate here, is not going to be Chadash because it must have been planted and even grew before Pesach. So the Chadash problem of the year is from Sukkot to Pesach. Because Sukkot to Pesach, you may already have things that reached market that were planted after Pesach. And therefore they're not going to be mutter until next Omer date. So I mentioned last week, what a lot of people who are Zohar in this do is, they store up a lot of stuff between Pesach and Sukkot to carry them for the year between Sukkot and Pesach. So you'll go to their basement and you'll see tons and tons of macaroni and bread and other things, because they buy it at a time when it's Yashan, and that's going to cover them for the period in which Chadash is a problem. There are also directories. Lakewood publishes different directories of products that don't have a problem, and barcodes as to when it was harvested and the like. So interestingly enough, although the Isser of Chadash is much stricter in Israel than it is in Chutz La'aretz, in Israel it's easier to keep because the Hashgachas certify it. In the United States or other countries, the Hashgachas do not certify it unless you see it with favors. Now what's happened though is that in recent years, by recent I mean not so recent anymore, maybe the past 25 years, there's been a greater commitment to the Din of Chadash. More and more people keep it. Part of it was Rav Soloveitchik's influence, both Rav Yosha Ber and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who were very big into the Din of Chadash and Yashan. And many of their Talmidim became pulpit rabbis. Many Rabbanim in the United States are Talmidim of Rav Yosef Dov and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So you'll find more and more bakeries, more and more caterers, more and more restaurants are being makbid on Yashan. But historically, the American Hashgachos were not certifying it. The Star K, I don't know. I don't remember now. The Star K may in fact be makbid on Yashan in Baltimore. I have to check. Yeah.
I have a question. So a lot of products can be imported from America.
Yeah.
And unless you have the code,
something to be careful about. Absolutely.
But how do you know?
Yeah.
You got to know. As I say, this time of year, this part of the year is not a problem. Right. So right now, there's absolutely no problem. After Sukkot, how do you know? You're going to have to get the link with directory. I think it's online for free. You can check a Chadash Yashan directory or call the Star K hotline. I mean, there must be a hotline in Eretz Yisrael. I'm sure there is. But I know the Star K hotline in Baltimore, 484-4110, that I still remember it, that everybody calls to get information. They can give you all sorts of information on all sorts of all sorts.
You know those yummy cookies from England that have the butter in them, OUD?
Yeah.
They're so good.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So buy them now. So
buy them now.
So now they're Yashan. Now they're Yashan. So buy enough now to carry you through.
That?
Of course, probably you buy too many cookie boxes ahead of time. You might
eat them.
You might finish them quickly. But try to buy them now and put them in a time-released lock or whatever. You know,
right, exactly.
Whatever,
buy them now, whatever, exactly.
So again, that's an important point. In other words, the obvious point is that Chodesh and Yashan are seasonal problems, meaning they're going to be a large part of the year in which everything must have been planted before Pesach in order to reach market by now. So if that's the case, it's not going to be a chadash problem. Okay, but people need to be aware of this. In fact, sometimes people have a shayla, you know, they want to know what chumrah. They're willing to keep one chumrah in America, and they give you a choice. Should I keep Yashan or Chalav Yisrael?
Uh-huh.
So the truth of the matter is, if you had to pick a chumrah, you're only going to do one, you're not going to do two. Okay. Yashan Chadash is probably more important than Chalav Yisrael.
Yeah.
And the reason is, the reason is,
not surprising,
because the halacha of Chalav Yisrael, that you can only drink milk that was milked under the supervision of a Jew, is a rabbinic decree. It's not a Torah decree at all. It's a rabbinic decree because the rabbis were afraid of the possibility of adulteration, which in any case is very, very, very rare. So number one, Chalav Yisrael is the Rabbanan, according to some opinions, Chadash, even in Chutz La'aretz, maybe in Isser D'oraisa. So a D'oraisa would take precedence over a Rabbanan. Number two, with Chalav Yisrael, we have Rav Moshe Feinstein's famous heter. I remember Moshe Feinstein's heter for non-Chalav Yisrael was based on the fact that when you have a government inspection system where a farmer or a dairy will get fined for adulterating the milk with any other ingredient, that takes the place of a mashgiach, meaning you don't need Chalav Yisrael when you have what is called the government regulation. That was Rav Moshe's heter to allow individuals. In fact, he invented a new term. It was called Chalav Stam, meaning Chalav Akam is milk from a guy that's unsupervised. Chalav Yisrael is milk that was supervised by a Jew. Chalav Stam is milk that was not supervised by a Jew, but it doesn't have the status of Chalav Akum because of government regulation. Now, it's very, very clear that although Rav Moshe's heter is widely, widely followed in the United States by many Orthodox communities, Rav Moshe himself obviously never followed that heter in his own life. And in fact, Rav Moshe has other tshuvas in which he encouraged all yeshivos and day schools to only use Chalav Yisrael, even if it would cost much more money. And these were schools operating on a very tight budget. He said it's important that they should be mechunach in Chalav Yisrael. So Rav Moshe himself didn't like his heter, but he said that there is indeed such a heter. So because of this, if you have to choose a chumrah, Chadash and Yashan would be more important than even Chalav Yisrael itself. They tell a story, I'll tell you two milk stories about Rav Moshe, just as a little aside. One story is that once he drank milk and coffee or something, and he then discovered after he drank it that it was not Chalav Yisrael, and some accounts were he vomited. His stomach literally could not be soybel this. Mm. And he vomited it. His son-in-law, Rav Moshe Tendler, Zichron Lebracha, said he didn't believe that would be a true story. And the truth is, I have a feeling it may not be true. Not because I don't believe that Rav Moshe would vomit it, I believe he would, but because he probably would not have been nichshel. He wouldn't have made such a mistake. So, okay. The other story is a cute story, and that is at the time in New York, I don't know how many years this was, 30, 40, more than that, maybe 50, 60 years ago, So there were two major Chal of Yisrael. There was Golden Farms and J&J. These were the two.
Golden Flow.
These were the two big ones. So the story goes that Moshe Bris went over to a Golden Flow milk container. He picked it up, looked at it, put it down, and then went to J&J. So this immediately, people always watched Rav Moshe like a hawk. Whatever he did, you know, why is he doing it? So they figured he must have had a shiloh with Golden Flow, and people stopped buying Golden Flow.
Oh, no.
And J&J got a lot of extra business, and somehow it came to Rav Moshe's attention, and he said, you know, Golden Flow is fine, no problem. So someone said, so why did you put it down? He says, the container was empty. So you got to be careful about this. So what a gadol does, you know, everything is watched. In fact, I think they tell the story about the Meir Simcha, that he wrote a letter once, put it in the mail, then he went to the post office to retrieve it, which was a difficult process. And the reason was because obviously he writes the name and address on the outside of the envelope. And he wrote it in Hebrew letters, the name in Hebrew letters. And this was a person who had an unusual name. And when you write a get, you have to be very, very meticulous in how you spell name. Meir Simcha didn't want people to maybe use the way he addressed the envelope for the spelling of a get. So he went back to rewrite it in Russian letters because he didn't want people to paskin from an envelope as to how you spell the name. You don't know. I don't know. Baruch Hashem, none of you should ever go through a get. But by far, the most difficult process in writing a get is simply figuring out names. Because number one, Hebrew names are relatively easy to spell. But in a get, you also have to put any name that the man or the woman is known by. So how you spell various, like how do you spell Charlotte? Like, you know, modern Hebrew is not necessarily the halachic, you know, because Hebrew has, English or other languages have certain phonetic sounds that are not directly in the Hebrew alphabet, like shah, cha, cha, tha, right? So how do you spell it? Many, many machloksa. And you also have to include nicknames. So you might say, Aviva, that is called Charlotte, that is called Sherry, that is called, daughter of, Yitzchak, who is called Isaac, who is called Ike. You know, you have to have like every single name and every single nickname. So that can take a long time. The Rabbanim have to sit and they have to go through every name and and then how you spell the names, and there are directories. I mean, I've come across literally like 6-volume works, which are just about spellings of names and spellings of places also. How do you spell Cherry Hill, whatever it would be, how do you spell Flagstaff, Arizona? And that's why there actually is a minhag sometimes, that we don't like to write a get in a place where we don't have a messiah of writing a get, meaning that's why they may not write a get in Flagstaff, Arizona. You may have to go to Memphis or whatever it would be, because if we don't have a messiah about how you spell a place, we don't go. Okay. Rav Aryeh Kaplan, Allah Fasholah, there's a collection of articles that the OU put out, the Aryeh Kaplan Reader. So one of his articles was the process of when they started writing a get in Muncie. For many years they did not write a get in Muncie, he had to go to Brooklyn. And then finally Muncie decided, we're important enough, that's a sign of Cheshivas, we're important enough that we should be able to write Gittin. And he describes in great detail how a base not to go to figure out the spelling, and also is Muncie, in fact even the municipalities are a little complicated. Is Muncie part of Spring Valley? Because technically Muncie is not, there's no mayor of Muncie, so what is Muncie exactly? Not so clear. Ramapo, there's all sorts of, that's what I think. I think it's officially town of Ramapo. Nobody uses the name, and that includes Muncie, Spring Valley, as neighborhoods, and Shechunot. And he writes a whole process how a base then had to determine all of these different issues before they would allow writing a get in Muncie. Yeah.
What do they do with Santa Monica, San Diego, San Jose, you know, the Santos?
Yeah. Why? Because it's saint or because just
because
how you spell it?
Because it's saint. I mean,
how saint? Listen, you know what they say. Satmar. What is Satmar? Satmar is Saint Mary. Satumare. So apparently we don't have too much of a problem with
okay.
San Francisco, you know, Los Angeles, City of Angels, whatever. Okay. But it's not a process. In fact, this person was just nipped very recently, Rav Nutzer Greenblatt, Zichrono Livracha,
who was I'm a Talmud.
Talmud, yeah, he was a very, very chashuva person, a chashuva posek. He was well into his 90s, and he kind of wrote Gittin, certainly for the entire southern part of the United States, and really a lot of the rest of the country too. And he was like maybe the world's one of the world's big experts. Many things, but writing Gittin was his particular forte, and he would go everywhere, even into his 90s, he would go anywhere in the United States, maybe the world, I don't know, to write Gittin. So it's a whole subspecialty about names and the like. Okay. Alrighty, so now...
Did the Rav know him personally?
I was not zochet to know him, no. The only Greenblatt I know of the family, I know Rav Nachum Greenblatt, who was Rav Ephraim Greenblatt's son. Rav Ephraim was Rav Nutzer's brother or nephew? I think it was Rav Nutzer's nephew. So Menachem was in St. Louis as his great nephew. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very chashuv people. They were extremely, extremely, extremely close to Rav Moshe Feinstein. They were
to whom?
To Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Talmidim.
Talmidim, yeah, yeah. Rav Nutzer and Rav Ephraim were very, very close to Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Rav Moshe told him to stay in the.
Yeah, yeah. The thing about the Greenblatts, both Greenblatts were in Memphis, both Rav Nutzer and Rav Ephraim Greenblatt. And it was amazing, they were great Talmidei Chachamim, I mean, Svarim and this, but they were very, very humble. I mean, you know, they taught like, you know, sixth graders for Bar Mitzvah,
That's what Rav Ephraim did.
Yeah.
I see him back at his class in the Memphis Hebrew Academy, waiting for those young Yingluck to come into his class.
It's quite an amazing
thing. Sixth grade.
It's quite an amazing thing. Rav Ephraim Greenblatt has not a lot anymore, but he had 10 volumes of Shelus HaTshuvos, Rav Ephraim. And 10 volumes of Shelus HaTshuvos. Like he was one of the biggest poskim in the United States. And yet he was, he would teach Bar Mitzvah boys and all sorts of like simple things. He was just part of the community available to people. That's a tremendous humility, you know. You figure someone of his stature wants to be a Rosh Hashiva, wants to, you know, be the head of, you know, of course he could have been a Rosh Hashiva, but he was Sameach, b'chelpa, to help Yidden in those situations. So it's really something to very much admire.
You saw Rabbi Ephraim?
Yes, Rabbi Ephraim, yeah. I didn't know him well. I know Menachem, I went to yeshiva with. Menachem is a little younger than me.
Can you just say who you're talking about?
I'm talking about a family, Greenblatt family.
Okay.
And there were two rabbis, both of whom lived in Memphis, an uncle and a nephew. The nephew died a few years ago, and the uncle just died a few months ago. And they both were great, great Talmidei Chachamim, but very, very humble in the sense that they just did anything that had to be done in the community and the like. So I just mentioned, I brought this up because the uncle who died was probably the biggest expert on get in the United States. And he would travel all over the place to help people with getting and the like. Of course, okay, well, just for gossip value, but I'll mention it. I mean, unfortunately, he had a lot of emotional sorrows in the last few years because he was involved in a very, very controversial case, and many, many Gedolim disagreed with his psak. You may have heard of this case. I was involved in the case myself before the marriage broke up. This involved a couple that was living in Washington or Silver Spring. And the woman decided she wanted a get. And they had a four-year-old daughter, and she went back to Philadelphia to be with her parents, and he was Zebrachin because he had to work in the Washington area. So he refused to give a get until she would relocate back to Maryland. Okay, we can discuss, is that legitimate or is not legitimate? One can debate about this, but Imamish was an aksha. He refused to give a get no matter what. So what Rav Greenblatt paskened was, he actually paskened that because he had certain pre-existing psychiatric conditions of OCD and various other things of which his wife was not aware, he paskened that this was a kedushin under a mistake. And because it was a kedushin under a mistake, she would not have agreed to marry him. She did not need a get.
But is the girl a mamzer?
No, the girl's not a mamzer. It just means it's not a wedlock child.
Oh,
not a
mamzer. Okay.
So this is an extraordinary idea, to mater a woman based on this idea that you don't need a get. I mean, I remember reading myself, I remember when the story came out. ORA is Organization for the Resolution of Agunas. It's out of YU, the guy who runs it actually lives here. And they help women to get a get. They have demonstrations, they had a lot of Facebook demonstrations and a lot of things, a lot of pressure. And finally, one day I read that from ORA, this has been resolved, this has been solved, the woman is no longer an aguna. Now, I knew before I read it, it couldn't have been he would give her a get because he wouldn't, he was stubborn in that way. So then I read that, but that doesn't explain it, that she does not need a get. I have no idea why, but it turns out that Rav Greenblatt had given a psak. Now, the problem.
What year was that? Okay.
This was maybe 8 years ago, less than 10 years ago. So, as a result, the woman got married to another guy, and she never received a get, but she got married based on Rav Greenblatt's psak. Now, talk about being thrown under the bus. There were some other rabbanim that agreed with Rav Greenblatt, but They withdrew their psak. They said, we can't support this. I mean, this is after she got married at that point. But Rav Greenblatt stayed with his psak to the very end, even though most poskim, most rabbanim, they all said, no, it's usser. That's a very, very uncomfortable place for Rav Greenblatt to be in, but even more so for this couple to be in. So I think they came to a conclusion that we're going to stay married based on Rav Greenblatt's psak, but we're not going to have children, because if we would have children, most of the poskim would say the kids are mamzerim, because if halachically she's still married to her first husband, that's going to produce mamzerim. So it's kind of a very tragic, uneasy outcome, because they're staying married even though most of the halachic world considers this to be an adulterous union. And they're not able to have children because they don't want to create a stigma of mamzerus that's going to attack. But it was Rav Greenblatt that gave the psak of annulment. And I can imagine that all of this created a lot of, I don't know, I didn't speak to him about it, but created a lot of agmas nefesh for him, who was already in his 90s when this happened. But this was a real controversial. You figure by the time you're in your 90s, you figure life will be a little, health permitting, life will be a little smoother at that point. You can kind of finish your business, but he gets hit with this major, major scandal at the end of his life. I mean, maybe it even contributed to his demise at some point, who knows. Okay, so that's a little bit of trivial information about it. So I'll tell you that the notion of annulling a kedushin, annulling a marriage based on a mistake or a misrepresentation, actually does have a precedent in one of Moshe Feinstein's tshuvos. And this is actually very interesting. This involved a woman who discovered that her husband was gay after she married him. And she wanted a get, he refused to give her a get. Rav Moshe paskened, she does not need a get, because heterosexuality is such an essential understanding of a marriage that there's no way she would have agreed to marry him had he been gay, and therefore Moshe paskened she does not need a get. That's an amazing thing. Now, you have to be careful. The notion of mistake requires that it be a pre-existing condition, meaning it's something that existed at the time of the marriage. If he became gay later, though one could argue there always must have been an inclination, but if he didn't manifest it until later, that would be grounds for a get. She could ask for a get, but she could not get out of the marriage without a get. I myself was involved in a case in Silver Spring. This is a very, very interesting Shaila, in which this actually happened to a woman. The woman was married. She discovered her husband was gay. She asked for a divorce. She got a get. She did get a get. But now she wants to marry a Kohen in her second marriage. Now, it's a little complicated because she actually did receive a get. Now, a Kohen cannot marry a divorced woman. But her argument was that since, according to Rav Moshe, she didn't need to receive the get, and the get was superfluous, she could rely on an annulment and be able to marry a Kohen the second time. Well, that's one idea. The other idea is, but she got a get. Once she got a get, that's going to pass on, right? So I remember the chief rub, so to speak, in Silver Spring was Rav Einemer, Zichrono Lebracha.
He was with us until what year, about? He was with us until about what year?
Rav Einemer was Nifter, I think, like 2013 or something. 13. Yeah, so this one's again, like, in the early 2000s. I was still in Chislaritz. So I remember that this was a member of Rav Einemer's show, and I was asked to be Mesader Kedushin. I said to Rav Einemer, am I allowed to be Mesader Kedushin for this? Kohen and a... So Rav Einemer said, you're allowed to, but he says he didn't want to do it. He asked me to do it instead. I said, are you sure that this is okay? He said, yes, I'm sure it's okay.
So she was able to marry Kohen?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I married them. But I still remember Rav Einemer said, it's mutter, but he doesn't want to do it, whatever.
Was the Rav near Rav Winter's show?
Well, it depends what near. I mean, Silver Spring is Silver Spring. I mean, right. You're not far from anything, but I was around, maybe, I don't know, 4 miles from Rav Winter's show.
And the Rav knew the Mogilinskis?
Oh, of course. Well, Mogilinskis are members of my show. I was a Rav in Woodside, so Mogilinski family is in Woodside.
So the Rav knows that my brother married a Mogilinski?
Yeah, of course. I knew that, sure, of course. Yeah. So those are different issues. So Rav Greenblatt was not machadesh, the idea of annulment, but he applied it to the psychiatric condition, which again, I can't argue with Rav Greenblatt, but the truth of the matter is, knowing the situation a little bit, knowing the actual situation, because I was involved in marriage counseling with this couple. It is a real problematical shot because it seems that the wife knew that her husband had kind of autistic spectrum issues. I mean, it wasn't like a big surprise to her that he was that way. So it's a little difficult to say she was totally like out of left field. All of a sudden, she discovered there were these problems. I mean, she was aware of it. She thought things could be worked out, and then she came to the conclusion things could not be worked out. So. It was a very, very daring psak, and it was very, very different than Rav Moshe's situation, where a man represents himself as heterosexual, and it turns out he's not. That's a clear case of deception and the like. Now, the underlying issue, which I'm not going to talk about really, but the issue, people say withholding a get is always bad, is always evil. We cannot tolerate it. The truth is, all rules have exceptions. And the truth of the matter is, in a case like this, it's not so clear that the husband is the bad guy. I mean, normally, someone withholds a get, they want money or they want to impose pain. Here, he simply was worried about the idea that if she moved out of state with a two-year-old child, he'll never really have a chance to see her. And all he wanted, he said he would give a get immediately if she would move back to Maryland, where he could have frequent visitation. Now, her argument was that as a single mother, she needed to be with her parents, or with her mother in particular, in her mother was in Philadelphia. So it's a hard case. She felt she needed parental support. He felt he needed his daughter to be closer. In fact, in many situations, there's actually a court order that a custodial parent cannot take a child, cannot move a child out of state, precisely for this reason. I'm not sure why he didn't have an order to that effect.
It's like a three-hour drive. I mean, really, give me a break. What's this problem? It's not like she's going to
Philadelphia to Maryland is not like California. No, you're right. But still, you know, when it's a short Shabbos, a short Friday, you know, it's not not that easy.
Boo-hoo.
Well, listen, it's a three-hour drive for her too, to her parents. You know, it's not. I mean, it's the same. It's the same. Same.
You can meet halfway.
Okay. So you have no sympathy for get abusers. Okay.
Come on. It's not like. Okay. He could see her if he wanted. Okay, I don't buy it.
Okay. We could debate. I mean, part of it.
Especially since Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love.
Brotherly love. Right. We're working things out. together. You know. So this was the issue, and again, part of the problem, you know, part of the issue also was the fact that he was on the autistic spectrum, which means things have to be a certain way. I mean, that goofy is part of the issue, that he could adjust in a certain configuration and he couldn't adjust in another configuration. So he wasn't a bad guy. It was a situation where he needed a certain framework and he couldn't get that framework, but he wasn't trying to hurt her. He just was using the get as,
agreed to move back to Silver Spring.
Yeah.
He gives a get.
Yeah.
Then she turns around and goes back to Philadelphia.
You're right. This was the enforcement mechanism. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course, sometimes men have argued that the get was given under false pretenses and the get is possible. I mean, there have been an argument sometimes that if I gave a get with this understanding and you don't keep it, your get is no good. Right? So some men have sometimes made that argument and sometimes, but they didn't have accepted it. So, you know, it's a little tricky in that way. Okay, I don't know how I got onto this. Rabbi Greenblatt, get. I don't remember the sequence of analysis here. But now let me get back to Chadash and raise a very interesting problem. Let's go back to after Moshe Rabbeinu dies. Moshe Rabbeinu dies on the 7th of Adar. So Yoshua becomes the leader. And the book of Yoshua says that they mourned for Moshe, or the Torah says, they mourned for Moshe for 30 days. So that takes you to the 7th of Nisan. And then Hashem appears to Yoshua, Perek Aleph of Yoshua, says to Yoshua, Chazak v'yamatz, be strong and encouraged. In 3 days, you will be crossing the Yarden River, and you will begin the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. Right? That's the beginning of Yoshua. And they cross the Yarden through a miracle, right? The waters of the Yarden split. Actually, he didn't split. It's different than the Yamsuf. The Yamsuf split in two. The way the Yarden worked was the river stopped flowing. In other words, the river is flowing, it just stopped and the water piled up like a wall. So there was no water on the other side at all, meaning they waited until the water in the channel drained and no new water came in. So it was a different picture. The Jewish people were not walking between two walls of water. They were walking simply in a channel that no longer had any flow of water. But be it as it may, they conquered Jericho, was the first city that was conquered, etc. But then it mentions they had the Korban Pesach. And it describes the great first Korban Pesach that they brought in Eretz Yisrael. Right? The first Korban Pesach. And it mentions there was a mass circumcision, because all the people who left Mitzrayim had circumcised before the Korban Pesach. But the children born in the Midbar did not circumcise, except for the tribe of Levi. For 40 years, all the children who were born in the Midbar did not have a prince. And therefore Yoshua is circumcising them. Why didn't they have a prince? What was the problem? So the Gemara basically says that from the time of the sin of the spies, they were not fully protected by the clouds of glory, and therefore it would have been a sakana, it would have been dangerous for children to have a bris in those conditions of traveling. So it's hard to imagine the generation that had the man and the clouds of glory and the traveling well and that received the Torah. Those newly born children did not have a bris milah.
What was the sakana, if you remember again?
The sakana was being in the desert, traveling would be dangerous for a child. They would be weak and the travel would not be good for the child. By the way, I'm sorry, I do have to make an announcement. I always forget to make an announcement. I very much apologize. The learning for the week of the 20 to the 25th of Sivan, June 19 to 24, is being dedicated in the loving memory of our dear sister on her 42nd Yahrzeit, Chaya Bluma Bas Avraham Meir, Aleha Shalom, Betty David Kahana, Aleha Shalom, Tehi Nishmata Tzurura Betzura Chayim. This is by Mel David and Dithi and Mendy Zwick. Again, I apologize for deferring the announcement, but we're very, very grateful for the Achzakas Torah, and may this be Le'iloi, Iloi Nishmata. Okay, so to go back to this, so everybody had a bris, and that's a very important point. And then it mentions that they had a problem because they couldn't eat of the grain of Eretz Yisrael, because all the grain that they encountered in Eretz Yisrael was chadash.
Huh.
It would not be mutar until the second day of Pesach, when they brought the Omer.
Huh.
So it mentions that until that point they were living off the man, that even though the man would normally spoil after one day, but Hashem allowed the man to remain a little bit, so they were living off the man until the second day of Pesach, when they were permitted to eat the chadash. And that's why the pasuk says, and I'll mention an interesting grammatical point, Vayochlu mi'avor ha'aretz, they ate from the grain of the land, mimacharas ha'pesach, from the day after Pesach. Now, interesting question. What does Pesach mean? Pesach. Well, Pesach means Passover, but what day of the calendar is Pesach? So we think Pesach is the 15th of Nisan, the day of the Exodus. Mimacharat HaPesach is the 16th of Nisan. And indeed, that's what it means in that pasuk, because when could they eat the new grain? On the 16th of Nisan, when they brought the Omer. So if 16th of Nisan is Mimacharat HaPesach, then Pesach is the 15th of Nisan. That's what it means in Yahushua. And yet, in the Torah, it means something very different. In Parshas Masai, it says, Mimacharas HaPesach Yatsu B'nei Yisrael. B'nei Yisrael left Mitzrayim the day after Pesach. What do you mean they left Mitzrayim the day after Pesach? They left Mitzrayim on the 15th. So what does Pesach mean in that pasuk? The 14th, when you bring the Korban Pesach. And in fact, the Torah actually has two different holidays for Pesach. There is what is called the holiday of Pesach, which is the 14th of Nisan and the night of the 15th. That's the holiday of the Korban Pesach. And then we have a seven-day holiday that is called Chag HaMatzos, the holiday of Matzah. And the night of the Seder is an overlap. It is the end of the holiday of Pesach and the beginning of the holiday of Matzah. So Rabbeinu Tam points out that the Lashon of Nevi'im and the Lashon of the Torah is not always consistent. In the Torah, Pesach means the 14th and Mimacharas HaPesach is the 15th. In the book of Yahushua, Pesach means the 15th, and Mimacharas HaPesach is the 16th. See, so you see a switch in the usage of language. So, based on this pasuk that they did not eat of the new grain until the 16th of Nisan, the Talmud Yerushalmi says the following interesting idea. That actually means at the first Seder that they celebrated, they did not eat matzah. They did not fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. Mishlama, we can eat matzah because we can eat matzah from last year's crop. So we can eat yashan. But here there's no, since the omer wasn't brought yet, all grain is chadash because there was no omer brought. So if they didn't eat the chadash until the bringing of the omer, that means they weren't allowed to eat matzah at the Seder. Even though eating matzah at the Seder is a Torah commandment, they didn't do it. They ate the Korban Pesach, they ate the Marar. They didn't eat matzah. Maybe they ate mun, whatever they ate for a bread substitute, but you're not yotze the mitzvah of matzah with mun. Mun is not one of the five species of grain. So the Talmud Yerushalmi then asks a kasha on its own analysis. And that is, there is a general rule called Asei Doche Losase. What does that mean? That if I have a positive commandment to do, and the only way I could fulfill the positive commandment is by transgressing a negative, I don't have a choice. The halacha is the positive commandment overrides the negative commandment, meaning you are allowed and even commanded to transgress the negative in order to do the positive if there is no way you could do the positive without transgressing the negative. Now, in a normal situation, if I had matzah that was chadash, I wouldn't be allowed to eat it at the Seder because I could get matzah that's not chadash. But in a case where all of the matzah that you have in the world, or all of the grain that you have in the world, is going to be chadash, why would I say I can't have matzah because of the Isser chadash? The Isser of chadash is a negative commandment. Thou shalt not eat chadash until the Omer is brought. Eating matzah is a positive commandment. Why do I not say that the positive should override the negative? Let me give you an example of where we say this. You know, doing a bris on Shabbos involves transgressing malacha. You're causing bleeding, etc. And yet we know that if Shabbos is the eighth day from the birth of the child, we do a bris on Shabbos. Aye, how can I do a bris on Shabbos? I'm desecrating Shabbos. The answer is, there's a positive mitzvah to do a bris. There's a negative prohibition to transgress Shabbos. If there's no way I can do the bris unless I transgress Shabbos, I say the positive overrides the negative. This explains why it's only an eighth day bris that overrides Shabbos and not a ninth day bris. Let's imagine the bris is late. So if I'm doing a bris on the ninth day, the tenth day, the 11th day, I can't just do it on Shabbos. I gotta wait the next day. Why is that? Because you see, there's a mitzvah to do a bris on the eighth day. And then if you didn't do that, there's a general mitzvah to do it as soon as you can later. So the general mitzvah, I don't need to violate Shabbos, I can do it later. So there's no need to invoke the principle of Asei Doche Lo Sase, because I can do the Asei without transgressing the negative. But with respect to the special mitzvah of Mila on the eighth day, if Shabbos is the eighth day, there would be no way I could do that mitzvah unless I violate Shabbos, right? That's why, right? So the question becomes, the Yerushalmi asks the question, why would they not eat matzah? Because of the Isser Chadash. Why do we not say, Asei Doche Lo Sase? Right? Why don't I say Doche Lo Sase? The Yerushalmi asks the question. And the Yerushalmi gives two answers why we don't say Asei Doche Lo Sase. Both of them are a bit technical. Answer number one is that since the mitzvah of bris, matzah was not given at Matan Torah, it was given in Mitzrayim, before Matan Torah, it doesn't have the chashivos of matan Torah mitzvahs. So the rule that an assay overrides a negative is only an assay that was given at matan Torah and onwards. It does not encompass a mitzvah that was given before matan Torah. It's hard to know the reason for that, but that's the first reason the Yerushalmi gives. The problem with that is, Bris Mila was also given before Matan Torah, and yet it does supersede Shabbos. Okay. The Yerushalmi then gives another reason, which actually says, Min HaTorah, they should have been able to eat matzah. But the rabbis, so rabbis go very early, time of Yehoshua, there was a rabbinic decree that since you'd only be allowed to eat matzah for the mitzvah, right? In other words, the mitzvah of matzah overrides the Isra of Chadash. But once you did the mitzvah of matzah, you wouldn't be allowed to have extra pieces. So the rabbis prohibited even the mitzvah, lest you come to eat more than the mitzvah, which would now be an aveira because it's not covered by the mitzvah. Right? So these are two answers of the Yerushalmi, why the first Seder, they didn't have matzah. They did not fulfill matzah, the first Seder. Now, just to end with one little ha'ara from the Ramban in Parshas Yisro, why would it be so that in cases of conflict, a positive mitzvah overrides a negative mitzvah? Why? Why do I give more precedence to the positive than to the negative? The Ramban says a very interesting idea. He says, negative commandments reflect what you might call fear of God. I'm not going to touch that. Right? I'm not going to touch that because I have fear and reverence of the Almighty. I'm not going to violate His commands. But doing things positively are expressions of your love of Hashem. When you love someone, you do for them. When you're afraid of someone, you avoid violating their will. So since love of Hashem is a greater and deeper emotion than fear of Hashem, the positive overrides the negative, because Avas Hashem is greater than Yerushalmi. This is what Ramban says in Parshas Yisro. Okay, well, we'll stop here and wish everybody a good week. Yeah.